Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind The Canary, Britain's leading independent news site. I'm Kerri-Anne Mendoza, The Canary's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Each week, we bring you a look behind the scenes at the biggest stories of the last 7 days. Today, it's anatomy of a disaster. On Monday 22nd of May, fans of pop singer Ariana Grande, mostly teenage girls and their parents, were having the time of their life. They sang along to One Last Time at the top of their lungs as pink balloons dropped from the rafters. Thrilled and delighted, they began to leave their seats and make their way out of the Manchester Arena. Little did they know, a suicide bomber was waiting, and he detonated his payload, killing 22 and injuring 64 people. The victims were Courtney Boyle, aged 19, and her stepfather Philip Tron, Chloe Rutherford, 17, and her boyfriend Liam Curry, 19, Georgina Callender, 18, John Atkinson, 28, 8-year-old Safi Roussos. Alison Howe and Lisa Lees were killed as they waited in the foyer for their daughters. Olivia Campbell, 15. Angelica and Martin Cleese had come to pick up their 15-year-old daughter. They were killed as they waited for her in the foyer. Their daughter later conducted a frantic Facebook search for her parents. 32-year-old Kelly Brewster died shielding her young niece from the blast. Martin Hett, 29. 14-year-old Nell Jones. 51-year-old receptionist and mother of three, Jane Tweddle Taylor, was at the venue to pick up a friend's daughter. Off-duty police officer Elaine McIver. Michelle Kiss. 15-year-old Aileth McLeod. Wendy Faywell. 14-year-old Sorrel Lechkovsky. 15-year-old Megan Hurley. Countless lives torn apart. A devastating day for Manchester and Britain. In the aftermath of the attack, there's a search for meaning. Why did this happen? How can we ever feel safe again? How can we better protect ourselves? We cannot answer those questions glibly. It will take time, patience, and a willingness to stay in the conversation long past the point of discomfort. Today, we will look at some of the issues raised by the bombing, what came before it and what came after it. I'll be joined by UK editor Beck Sumner and Canary writers James Wright and Steve Topple. And welcome, team. So if we start with Beck's, we now have armed soldiers patrolling UK streets. What's happening there and why?
Yeah, so the day after the attacks on the 23rd, Theresa May made a live broadcast and raised the terror threat level from severe to critical. And she also announced that UK sort of armed forces would now be patrolling British streets. There's basically going to be up to 500 of them, and they'll be protecting key sites like Buckingham Palace and Downing Street. And the aim really is to free up police resources. So we might be seeing, you know, armed forces at events patrolling key sites.
Okay, and like, what's the name of the operation? Who came up with this as a strategy?
So it's the operation's called Operation Tempora, and it was news of it first leaked in 2015 when a document was uploaded to a website, and the Mail on Sunday got hold of it. And it was meant to be used if there were several simultaneous threats at any point. Police leaders were saying that they no longer had the resources to cope in those circumstances. It had a pretty frosty reception. The whole idea of using armed forces to help shore up the police had a pretty frosty reception generally. So Yvette Cooper slammed it she was slamming the cuts, really, to say that the cuts were putting our national security at risk. you know, in 2015, actually, there was a lot of noise about the Police Federation was arguing that they no longer had the resources to cope. Theresa May accused them of scaremongering. But yeah, their predictions seem to have come true, sadly.
Yeah, because they actually said that Britain would be forced to adopt, and this is the quote, forced to adopt a paramilitary style of policing. That was the Police Federation in 2015, and less than 2 years later, that has actually happened.
That's actually a really good moment to move to you, actually, James, because as you say, Theresa May was warned about this very eventuality in response to her cuts to police 2 years ago. Theresa May actually spoke to the Police Federation on the 20th of May, 2015, so 2 years almost to the day before the Manchester attacks.
The Federation warned that spending reductions mean that we'll be forced to adopt a paramilitary style of policing in Britain. Today you said that neighbourhood police officers are an endangered species. I have to tell you that this kind of scaremongering does nobody any good.
So, James, do you want to explain what's actually happened to police forces across the UK under the Conservative government?
Yeah. Okay, so the Police Federation, which is a staff association representing around 170,000 officers, the chairman of that association said that, well, he essentially said that Operation Tempora, the army deployment, wouldn't be necessary without conservative austerity, so budget cuts. No. And some recent reports show what those budget cuts are actually like. So overall staffing levels are down 17.4% from between 2009 to 2016.
Wow. How many people is that? How many officers?
That's a loss of 20,000 police officers.
Wow.
And another recent report says that policing is in a potentially perilous state. But of course, as we said before, more specifically, the warning that the Police Federation made in 2015 about paramilitary style policing has happened, and there is actually a link between how many trained firearmed officers have been axed since 2010 and how many troops that have been deployed is quite a similar level. So the data seems to add up with what the Police Federation is saying.
Just to add something in on that point, in the past 15 years, the number of armed police officers has now been halved. We now have 5,500 armed police officers. And the Conservatives promised after the Paris attacks that they would put 1,500 more armed police officers on the streets. And that has not actually panned out. So this has kind of been in the making, if you like, for quite a while.
It really is staggering. You look back over the past few years. I was looking at, you know, just after the Westminster attacks, you had a Prime Minister's Question Time with Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the Labour Party, challenges Theresa May on this point.
Corbyn. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Of course, we all pay tribute to the police for the work they do, but there are some problems that between 2015 and 2018, there'll be a real terms cut in central government funding to police forces of £330 million. Can the Prime Minister assure the House that police all over the country have the necessary resources to do the job?
Prime Minister.
I would remind the Right Honourable Gentleman that what we've done in the CSR is actually protected that police budget. And of course, the former Shadow Home Secretary, his own colleague, the Right Honourable Member for Lee, prior to the 2015 Labour Party conference, said savings can be found. The police say 5 to 10% over the Parliament is just about doable. Yeah. We didn't accept that. We've actually protected the police budget. I've been speaking, as my Right Honourable friend the Home Secretary has, to police forces, and they are very clear that the work that they are doing has the resources that they need.
Me, Corbyn.
Mr. Speaker, the Police Federation survey recently undertaken reveals that 55% of serving police officers say their morale is low due to the way in which their funding has been treated. Frontline policing is vital in tackling crime and terrorism. Since 2010, however, there are 20,000 fewer police officers, 12,000 less on the front line. So I ask the Prime Minister again, will she think again about the cuts to policing and guarantee policing on the front line will be protected so every community can be assured it's got the police officers it needs in their community.
Prime Minister.
Said to the Right Honourable Gentleman, we have protected those police budgets, including, of course, the precept that they're able to raise locally.
We know there have been massive budget cuts. There's 20,000 fewer police officers, armed officers halved. And she's up in front of the public saying exactly the opposite. I mean, how can people trust her?
And it's the same across the board, isn't it? It's the same with nurses.
Yeah.
It's the same with teachers. And now it's the same with police. And we've heard a lot about nurses being forced to use food banks and charity, but what we've heard less about is what the Police Federation said on May 17th, where they told Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, that it's also police officers that are being forced to use charity because of these cuts, which is just outrageous, really.
Also, in you know, at the Police Federation conference in 2015, there was an Greater Manchester former inspector who explicitly warned May that intelligence in Manchester had dried up, that there was no proactive policing, that they were just reacting, that nobody knows what's happening anymore as a result of the cuts. So, yeah, it's not like she hasn't been warned.
So what's true is no leader can promise to stop all terrorist attacks, and anyone who promises that is lying. But political leaders can ensure that the service is there to protect us when we need them, are fully funded and operational when we need them. And it's in this that Theresa May has failed. And she's not just failed when it comes to our national security. Theresa May is also removing protections that give us security in old age. And speaking more on this, we have Steve Topple. So Steve, welcome. You've continued to investigate the dementia tax this week. Can you explain what this tax is?
Indeed. Okay. So I was looking into the dementia tax, as it's now been labelled by just about everyone. And it's basically saying that old people, if they require care provided by the state, that their home is now considered part of their assets and part of their ability to pay. So in essence, in layman's terms, what this is that people have to take out some sort of equity release policy or some sort of lifetime mortgage, and that when they die, any care they've had from the state will be valued up and taken away in the form of the assets they hold, so taken out of the amounts of inheritance they give to their children in the form of their home. There's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing on this. Theresa May has done, I think the IFS described it on Friday, the 26th of May, as being an O-turn, not a U-turn, an O-turn.
What's an O-turn when it's at home?
Well, an O-turn, they called it, because she originally said there was going to be a cap on the amount of care people could receive. Then she said there wasn't, and she said there is now going to be a cap again. So I think O-turn means that she's running around in circles chasing her tail, obviously.
Sounds about right. And I've noticed as well, just for the record, that the Conservative manifesto does not contain a cap. That's correct.
Absolutely. I went through it with a fine-tooth comb as well. And it was interesting watching it, Kerri-Anne, because all the media as well, even the most sort of conservative supporting media, all came out and said, nah, that weren't in the manifesto. What's going on? Like Laura Koonsberg even said, I had to have a lie down after that.
she accused her of being in panic, and I quote, that's Laura Koonsberg.
Yeah,
my goodness.
Absolutely. It was interesting. So, yeah, that's kind of the overview. Basically, that so you work all your life, get a mortgage, have a house, and now the government is going to take it off you to pay for the care which you paid national insurance contributions for, in essence.
So this has basically gone down like a lead balloon with about everyone, hasn't it? I've seen a unified opposition to this across even the mainstream press, independent press, about every demographic of voter. And then we've had Theresa May come out and perform her, as you describe it, an O-turn. But you were having a look this week, Steve, at not only kind of the possible negative impacts of the policy in terms of who it's going to hurt. We were actually discussing this on the podcast last week in terms of kind of who it would harm, and actually asking ourselves, who is this tax actually designed to benefit? Like, who's going to be happy about this policy? And you've actually done some digging on that this week. What did you find?
Okay, so I looked into this because, as is always the case with the Conservatives, there has to be a bit of a hidden agenda here. There's always something going on behind the scenes. So I did some digging, and it turns out, three guesses. Guess who's going to benefit from this? The Tories' friends in the city.
No.
So I kind of tracked the timeline of where this policy may have come from. And I went back to 2011 when the now much cited Andrew Dilnot review into social care in England was published. This is the review that the Conservatives have basically ignored in their manifesto. For example, he said there should be a cap of £35,000 on the cost of care. Any lifelong support should be given free. And there's been major controversy around this because the Conservatives have ignored most of his recommendations. However, what it did say was, and I quote, "At the moment, no major financial services providers offer pre-funded insurance against social care costs. This means people are not able to protect themselves in advance of having a care need." So Dilnot highlighted in 2011 that no insurance policies offered any protection against social care costs in your retirement. Okay, so then in January 2014, the government and the Association of British Insurers launched what they called a statement of intent, and this was in conjunction with the Care Act of the same year. What this did was basically make local authorities legally responsible for ensuring that people were pointed in the direction of private financial advisors to give them offers and give them instructions on how to get insured for social care in later life. It basically turned local authorities into salesmen, if you like, for the insurance industry in the UK.
Oh my God. The-
This is where Legal & General come in, and this is where it gets interesting. In June 2015, Legal & General launched its own lifetime mortgage product, and it, the idea was that it wanted to become a leading provider of these kind of products. Lifetime mortgages basically allow people to release funds from their property to put towards the cost of care in later life. Mm-hmm. Then Legal & General, again, after the Brexit vote, they said that the sort of five key long-term growth options for them that they saw after Brexit included aging populations and welfare reform. Aging populations one is obviously interesting because of their goal to become a leading provider for lifetime mortgages. Mm-hmm. This is where Theresa May comes in. Just after the Brexit vote in July 2016, May appointed someone called John Godfrey as her number 10 director of policy. Now, this guy was previously director of corporate affairs at Legal and General. And as the Times noticed and wrote about, his role at Legal & General was also included the lobbying of ministers on behalf of the insurance company, lobbying being to get MPs to listen to private companies and try and put forward policies and proposals that would benefit them. So he was also involved in lobbying. Now Theresa May has put him into the heart of number 10 to advise on policy. And this revolving door continued with Legal & General when a senior Treasury official, John Kingman, left the Treasury to become chairman of Legal & General. And so what happened after that? Well, March 2017, we'll fast forward to there. Legal & General was then the market leader of lifetime mortgages and equity release plans. They had nearly a 30% share of the market in the UK. The Tories also appointed then the chief executive of Legal & General's investment management arm, Martin Kula, to the board of the UK corporate government watchdog, the Financial Reporting Council. And we're then bang up to date with the Tory manifesto stating, "We're going to take your home if you need care in later life." Now, look, the long and the short of this is, no one's saying that Legal & General were holding a gun to Theresa May's heads and saying, "You've got to make sure that older people have to buy our equity release plans."
Yeah.
But
yeah,
what this is a perfect example is, as we keep seeing with the Conservative Party, it's this corporatism, the blurred lines between big business and big government, and the influence and the scope that major corporations have over policymaking, and especially with the Conservative Party. It's that kind of drip, drip, drip of influence from the city into government, and this is just another prime example of that, if you like.
Yeah, I think the other thing that concerned me about this, Steve, was it's almost like the end game of the model we've been talking about, with the Conservative effort to privatise the NHS by stealth. It almost feels like this social care is almost kind of a shot across the bows, almost like a first go at doing that, because what they've done with social care, as you say, is just over years, and not just the Conservatives, in fairness, New Labour did this too, seriously underfund social care, creating a crisis, then bringing in, you know, private providers to so say ease this crisis, you know, fill this gap, and then ultimately removing all responsibility effectively from government to provide those services any longer. Because this is pretty much what's happening with social care now. It's pretty much that's it for state-funded social care, as far as most people are going to know it.
Yes, absolutely. It is exactly the same thing as the NHS. It's this long-term stealth privatisation, if you like, exactly the same as we've seen in the NHS. I mean, you can trace the roots of the current NHS situation, if you like, back to the 1980s and the likes of Tory MP Oliver Letwin producing a pamphlet all about the privatisation of the NHS. And then they slowly drip little bits in here and there. I mean, if you look at the figures for the amount of money that goes from the NHS into independent companies, that's doubled since 2010. It's now £8.7 billion a year is being paid out of Department of Health money to independent providers for the NHS. We see 30% of NHS contracts now going to private companies. But this is the whole challenge with these kind of methods that both New Labour and the Tories employed to take our public services away from us. They don't do it like snap, suddenly you wake up one morning and everything's privatised and you've got to pay for the damn thing going. They don't do it like that. They do it over time. It's a drip, drip, drip of changes in policy, changes in direction, lessening of facilities that are available to the public, until eventually people don't even notice it's happened. They're unaware that it's really going on. But it's a long-term, long-winded, very cleverly executed game, if you like. And as you say, we're seeing it in the NHS, we're seeing it in social care now. And to be honest, this kind of ties in back to the story about the police and the army relating to the Manchester bombings. It ties into that as well, because you see companies like G4S, for example, now controlling a lot of backroom operations of the police, like the call centres. The same thing has happened around there. It's classic shock therapy that Naomi Klein described in her 2007 book, The Shock Doctrine. It's underfund something so much that it just collapses, and then the public has to agree and has no choice into private providers being put into it to save it.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the same. That completely echoes Noam Chomsky as well, who calls it the standard technique of privatisation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and this is not a conservative thing. This goes back to the likes of free market economist Milton Friedman, the Chicago School economist. Mm. He was doing this stuff in America in the like the 60s. If you look at the coup in Guatemala, that was basically pushed by the United Fruit Company. The American government were doing it for a private company and claiming they're bringing democracy to that country. This goes back decades and decades.
Absolutely.
And decades.
Well, and ditto, you know, the assassination of Salvador Allende and the, you know, installment of Pinochet in Chile, essentially so that the, you know, Milton Friedman and his Chicago boys could conduct an economic experiment.
That's
you know, with Chile, so they could say, okay, let's just put through all of these austerity policies because we have a dictator installed, so there's no issue of, you know, democratic, you know, inconveniences, you know, of public opinion. You know, and again, that was kind of touted as some sort of economic miracle. And you just go, these people will stop at nothing. Like, they're literally willing to work with a dictator to test their policies out before they tried it on us. And, you know, it was only half a century before that moved from the type of thing you needed to do with a dictator in government to the type of thing Theresa May is doing now.
Yes.
You know, you couldn't put a cigarette paper between the types of policies that we're seeing. And now I'm just going to hand you over to Nancy, who's going to let you know how you can get in touch with us at Canary Pod.
Hi, this is Nancy from the Canary. We hope you've been enjoying Canary Pod. If you are, please take the time to subscribe, rate, and review Canary Pod on iTunes or your chosen podcast platform. That's the only way that more people will see it in their recommended podcast list, and with something as important as a general election coming up, we'd like to reach as many new Canaries as possible. If you'd like to get in touch, we're on Twitter at CanaryPod, or you can email us on podcast@thecanary.co. Bye!
Okay, we're back. This is Kerri-Anne Mendoza. You're listening to Canary Pod. The point needs to be made again and again is that it does not save us money to privatise these services. No. Like every study, every report by the Public Accounts Committee through to independent, you know, reports done by, you know, journalists and academics across several universities. So all of these studies, one after the other, show that it's always more expensive. And, you know, social care is where it's hurting most right now. You know, the average cost now of a nursing home place for someone is over £39,000 a year. That's a phenomenal amount of money, especially when you consider that the average wage in the UK is only just over £26,000 a year. So this is, you know, you could take every penny that you'd earned in a year and it wouldn't fund you a nursing home place for the same period of time. And the same is true across the board. So we do need something else.
Yeah, I agree with all that, Kerri-Anne, obviously. I think there's another important point to be made, though. Legal in general, in a study by a Swiss university for The New Scientist, Legal in general was rated as the seventh most powerful corporation on the planet, as in the study that was done broke down who owns the 54,000 multinationals that exist in the world, and ultimately came down to 147 companies, and Legal in general was the seventh in that list. This is a massively powerful corporation that we're dealing with here. And this is a challenge with these stealth privatisations like we're seeing in the NHS, like we're seeing with social care, like we're seeing with police. We're not dealing with just a UK issue here. This is a systemic global problem. And as we touched on earlier, this is not even a Thatcherite Reagan problem. This stemmed from the 60s and that school of thought that free markets reign and the private sector is best and the public must just be coerced by whatever method necessary into agreeing to this. It's a huge problem, which is almost extra governmental, if you like. It's something which we can vote at the ballot box, but it ain't going to be changed overnight. It's so entrenched now that I think it's going to come to a point where we're going to have to think of a different way of looking at it. Because it's just absolutely, the scale of the problem is astonishing in my eyes.
Absolutely. I mean, I can remember, you know, reading Professor Steve Keen's book, Debunking Economics, which is fantastic, by the way. I'd recommend all listeners have a read of it. It does a great job of unpicking all of the sort of flawed assumptions behind neoclassical economics, which is derivative of neoliberal socioeconomic policy, which is actually the system we live in, whether we like it or not. That's basically where we are. And he actually says in the book, and I've seen him speak publicly about it as well, is that actually this whole economic ideology is now, it's not a political or social science, it's now zealotry. Because a political or social science asks questions. When its assumptions are proven false, it produces a new theory, it moves itself along. And yet what neoclassical economics does, and neoliberalism does in general, is despite the like overwhelming evidence that its policies do more harm than good to the majority of people, that the most basic assumptions behind their economic models are untrue and ineffective at, you know, predicting outcomes, i.e. none of them saw the financial crash coming in 2007-08. Despite all of that, they just carry on regardless. Like, I mean, it's much closer to that sort of religious ideology where it's kind of seen as a faith which is unshakable, you know, in the face of any challenge, as opposed to a science which says this is our working theory, now it's been proven false, we will go another way.
It suggests a clash of aims, really, because with all, you're looking at all that data and you're not thinking there's a problem, then maybe your aim side of profit and more on the side of making what is essentially a risk-free investment, because if it's the demand is guaranteed for the shareholders, you know, demand is guaranteed that people are going to need houses, so you can just duplicate your money by buying up property in London, and then people are forced to rent it because people aren't just going to live in a bush, are they? You know, or the same with healthcare. Everyone is going to have some kind of healthcare issues. So if you invest in certain areas of profitable areas of healthcare, then you're guaranteed to make money. So it's a cash cow, basically. So
yeah, we were talking about exactly this in last week's podcast, weren't we? That it's,
yeah,
it's, especially in the context of housing, it's socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of almost, it feels like actually, you know, especially as, you know, Steve touched upon it, James touched upon it, this revolving door of this same, you know, it used to be the same class of people. Now it's literally the same people, you know, moving from, you know, the corporation that's delivering a service and is actively looking for customers, moving themselves into government to then create the policy that, you know, that corporation will benefit from, and then moving over to the regulator to make sure that when that corporation, no doubt, as they always do, fail to deliver upon their services or deliver those services at a vastly higher cost, which imperils the people that depend on upon them, that no rigorous action is taken.
And but that is how the system works, and the challenge with the system is that whatever you seem to throw at it, whatever people seem to try, it will always find a way to come out on top. A prime example is something called inclusive capitalism, which was developed in 2012-2013 by basically a group of bankers, and it was adopted by both Ed Miliband and Ed Balls in the Labour 2015 manifesto, but they called it inclusive prosperity. And all it is, it's capitalists trying to fix capitalism. It's basically saying, well, we know there's a problem with equality, so we're going to give everyone a little bit more just to make sure they're happy, but it's like it just puts sticking plasters over the problem, and they always try and find a way to outwit us, if you like, and keep the situation and the status quo pretty much as it is, even though we know it's never actually going to change. There is no way of, well, there is a way of resolving this, but it's not necessarily any of the options we're being given at the moment. So
I think this is a really good point you make, because this isn't something you can tinker with. I think that was probably the biggest kind of fallacy of the New Labour era, which we've now proven, because we're paying the price of that era now. You know, this idea that you can, like, softly, nicely, you know, make a compassionate, caring, you know, capitalism. And it's that there is no morality in capitalism. That's the whole point of capitalism. It's not that Legal & General or Unilever or, you know, General Electric, any of these companies are doing these things because they're evil, you know, people. That's an opinion, like that's a subjective opinion you can have, but the drive behind it is not cruelty or evil. It's amoral. Like, the purpose of that organisation is to generate maximum profits, to open new markets. That's what they're going to do. That's literally their function. The CEO of that company has a fiduciary responsibility to make the maximum profit for the shareholders. That's what they're going to do regardless. And that's why it's so dangerous to then place these amoral, you know, profit-hungry organisations anywhere near critical services. You know, there need to be an absolute barrier, firewall against, you know, those companies being a part of that, because their role is, they are not caregivers. They are not there to, you know, create a public good. They are there to create a profit for their shareholders. There might be, you know, companies who do care. There might be individuals working within those companies who do care. But seldom will that care or concern be placed above the profit motive for that organisation. And so to have this, like, fundamentally toxic relationship between a government, which the government's primary concern is its citizens. The government's primary focus should be representing the concerns and the ambitions of the people who elected them to govern, and everyone who didn't as well. And now we've got these hands together.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, that the first thing that needs to be sort of put forward is that these critical essential services need to be protected.
Yeah.
I don't think we need to necessarily go all the way back into a debate just between capitalism and socialism as these absolute theories, if you know what I mean.
Like,
I think there is first a massive distinction to be made between essential services and the rest of the economy, and then establishing at first a mixed economy based on that. Because if you just try and reduce debate to capitalism and socialism, it's really divisive. It has all sorts of problems, and there's all sorts of ways of where, you know, there's the statist type of socialism, or there is a cooperative model, which could be a lot better for capitalism. Because if a business works in a cooperative model, then everyone gets the benefits if the whole business does better, because everyone gets paid more if the workers themselves are the shareholders, which is, you know, a really good incentive for a business to do well rather than these distant shareholders. So yeah, the cooperative model could be good for the rest of the economy, but I think the first thing to do is to say, look, these essential services, it doesn't work trying to provide them on a profit basis.
Absolutely. I think you make a fantastic point there, actually, James. I think for a lot of people, they feel like, you know, change that would make a difference is so far away, it's almost not worth making any change at all. And actually, you know, what you've put there very, very neatly is that actually there are things we could do immediately. And actually, you know, you could vote Labour on 8th of June. Some of those will happen. You will have the nationalising of core critical services. And I think, as you say, one of the things that can happen then is that, you know, people will actually see the night and day difference between, you know, what they've been sort of raised on, really. You know, if you're under 30, you've pretty much been raised on the sort of Thatcher doctrine and of, you know, greed is good, private services are always more efficient than public services, all of that stuff. And you'd actually then have a proper comparison for those people, which I think would be really useful.
Yeah, exactly. And we do have that comparison now, just looking at something like the railways, which won't cost anything. It won't cost a penny to nationalise. It's not really even nationalising it. It's just ending the contract, ending the private contract. So it will be free to take back into public ownership. And we can see the comparison now throughout almost all of the European democracies have their own their railways. And we see much cheaper, like, I don't know, three times cheaper rail fares, and much cheaper rail fares in proportion to your income, because of the obvious fact that all the profits will be reinvested. And then with energy, we have it's pretty much copying the scheme in Germany, and it's not full nationalization. The big five will still be, it will compete against the big five, publicly owned local renewable energy sources in every region of the country, like they've rolled out in Germany, which has been extremely successful. I think the other week, Germany ran something like 98% of its electricity from renewables for one day or something, which is a record for a European country.
It is actually, I mean, listeners, go and look at what's happening in Germany in terms of energy, because I think it's actually one of the most, well, the most exciting energy policy happening anywhere in the world in terms of decentralization and engaging citizens in creating their own energy, which makes them then more responsible users and consumers of that energy. But they've also created something around 500,000 jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's just that there is no downside to this policy, you know, and they took a really courageous decision. You know, this has happened over 10, 15 years. So this was a long-term commitment by the government to move in a different way rather than a short-termist, you know, snatch and grab. So they basically said, instead of going the new nuclear route, which is kind of where Britain's been going and France has been going, they actually said, you know what, you know, stuff the short-term climate targets, we'll stick with coal, we'll let our coal stations run down, but while they're running down, we will build a replacement sustainable energy plan over, you know, 10 to 15 years, essentially almost over a generation. And they've done it, and they're now starting to see the fruits of that, both economically and environmentally. It's astonishing. Really, really courageous decision making, you know. And could we have some of that here, please?
It is correct, just, and it is interesting to look at. But just to play devil's advocate in all of this, income inequality in Germany has hit new highs at the end of last year. So it's very nice that they're doing all this with energy. But again, we're back to the system and the methods and the mechanisms that are embedded in this system. As I say, it means all well and good doing policies on energy like this. Income inequality is out of control in Germany. So that is, we're still at this root systemic issue, however you look at it, and whatever tinkering you do, in my opinion.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that we would copy Germany's whole economic model just from the energy side of it. Is a shining example of how this sort of system could work.
Interestingly, back in I think it was 2007 or something, David Cameron was really into decentralised energy. Do you remember when he was hugging huskies?
Vote blue, get green, wasn't it? Yeah.
He was really into the decentralised energy model. And that went out the window very quickly indeed.
Yeah. He was also into legalising drugs when he was younger as well. But I don't think that's something, his ambitions probably put that to one side, because I don't think he could really rise in the ranks of the Conservatives with those kind of views.
Yeah, exactly.
Little bird told me apparently he's into pigs as well, but that's a whole other topic. Okay.
That doesn't stop you. That doesn't stop you, right?
I know. That doesn't preclude you from being Prime Minister of Britain. Okay. So that seems like a natural place to bring today's podcast to a close. So I'd like to thank Bec Sumner, James Wright and Steve Topple for joining me today. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Canary Pod. Wishing you a good week ahead. And remember, don't get angry, get involved.